So I guess by the reading of the verse, you probably realize the topic that we're going to be talking about here tonight. So I'm sure that you aren't aware of this, but sometimes my sermons can be a little long. So I'm actually scheduled to preach next Sunday. That was my regularly scheduled time. But this Sunday, the schedule became open, and Tom asked me about a month or so ago if I could also preach this Sunday. And I said, sure. And I said, actually, I got this sermon that's going really long, so I basically separated it into two sermons. So because it was going to be pretty long. So I thought, well, okay, this is definitely one that can be separated into two. So part one is going to be, in fact, tonight. Part two will be next Sunday morning. Actually, Carl asked if we could swap, so I'll be preaching Sunday morning next week. So we'll talk about part two here. Speaking about fathers, it's a tough topic, but I do promise that although the opportunity is really there, I'm not going to share any antics from our family growing up. So I'm going to try to be good and not speak of things that happened in our family as being the father. So I'm not going to share any of that tonight. So I know that someone here may appreciate that. So, but one thing I do want to say, and kind of if you can indulge me, and I can shamelessly do this. I guess Letitia and I are just really proud of of how Ryan and Sarah are raising our grandkids. Really pleased with that. I don't think we could do a better job. And so that kind of epitomizes to me what fathers do. But you know, not just that, we have a lot of young families in this congregation that I think are doing outstanding jobs of raising their kids. And I really appreciate that. So you might say, well, all right, so why are we having a lesson on fathers then? Well, because any time that everything in the Bible should be spoken of, it should be addressed, it should be preached, and all of us can do better. All of us can you know, go over some, you know, this, of course, material again, and that would be, in fact, helpful. So, having said that, if you will look with me at Hebrews chapter 12, verses 3 through 11, Hebrews 12, verses 3 through 11, the Hebrew writer says, "For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. And you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them. But he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it." And then if you'll turn over to Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. "And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath or anger, but bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord." So what I'm going to do, and how I broke these up, we're going to spend the entire sermon, parts 1 and 2, will just be in Hebrews 6 and verse 4. And I've split it up, you know, based on a like negative command. The first part of verse 4 says, "And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath." It's kind of a negative command. Don't do this. And then the second half of verse 4 is kind of a positive command. But bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. So tonight we're going to talk about just the first one. Do not provoke your children to anger. Next Sunday morning we'll talk about the second half. And actually, if we were to read, in fact, Colossians 3 and verse 21, it says pretty much the same thing. We studied Ephesians when Ryan taught, the adult class here for many weeks. And really beginning in chapter 4, Paul is moving from talking about the foundations of what it means to be united with Christ to the wonder of God in the gospel. And then he moves from that to, in fact, practical applications starting in chapter 5. What it means to live for Christ in an alien world that we live in. That we should be living distinctive lives marked by, in fact, purity in a dirty world, honesty and integrity in a shady world, and by fidelity in a world which disregards the promises that we're supposed to keep in God's word. And now we're in a world that is marked in the realm of family life by the clear instruction of the Bible as it relates to what it means to be an obedient child of God. And what it means to be wise, a thoughtful, and a caring father and mother. In other words, he wants his readers to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you've been called. That's what he says in chapter 4 and verse 1 in Ephesians. He wants you to walk in a way that is worthy of that calling. And we're in the middle of a passage here that is very practical in nature, in which he's tackling three key areas here. And one area is in chapter 6, verses 5 through 8, what I'm kind of calling the matter of daily employment. Now, he's talking about a slave and a master, but that's the same kind of relationship, similar, that we would have with an employer, right? God expects us, whatever we do, to do to the best of our ability. And if we're working for a supervisor, for a manager, for, in fact, a company, we're expected to do our best, right? And that we're expected to not dishonor God in some kind of, worldly behavior. And then the second area in chapter 5, verses 22 through 33, is the relationship of husbands and wives. He talks about marriage there. And again, of a very practical nature. Learning that a society can only be healthy and happy when the marriage bond is held in honor. And so often today it's not. And then finally, and coming to the matter at hand for tonight in verse 4, is the responsibilities of, in fact, parental authority. And that's what we're going to be talking about here tonight. And it is because of this that Paul, in a couple of his letters, talk about disobedient children. If we look at Romans chapter 1, and this, I think one of the first times that I really read this, it really struck me. If we look at Romans chapter 1, beginning in verse 20, for since, and Paul is talking here to the Gentile Christians who used to be, of a worldly nature. And he says in verse 20, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they didn't glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, he says they became fools. Then jumping down to verse 28, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, and God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness, they are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, and boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful, who knowing the righteous judgment of God that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. And it struck me the first time that I read that, of all this list of terrible things, murderers and haters of God, right there in the middle it says disobedient to parents. And we might, think, wow, does that really fit there? So I didn't disobey my mom or my dad. Is that big of a deal? To God, it is. To God, it is. And so it's quite striking that it comes right at the heart of it. And it is on account of that that he has listed a clear and comprehensive call for children to obey and to honor their parents. And having done so in the first three verses of Ephesians 6 that Jerry read, he is addressing in verse 4 the parental role, and particularly that of the father. Let me just say, and I've said this before, back when I gave a sermon on, in fact, marriage, that here is another area where we need to right up front express our conviction for the Bible. concerning the authority and the reliability and the sufficiency for the Bible. In a culture where marriage is under bombardment by all fronts, are we then prepared to say, as Christians, that God knows best, that He in fact created us in this manner? He has made us both man and woman, and that He knows exactly how things are to be. Are we prepared to say that? Because what we're going to read in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4, a lot in the world say, no, that's not how you do that these days. They're trying to, in fact, debunk that kind of thing. When we come to the issue of family life and parental authority, there's a lot of misinformation in the world today, as all of you no doubt will agree. I was reading, I pulled up the United Nations, a treaty called the Declaration of the Rights of the Child. Pretty dry reading. And whereas I agree with a lot of what they say, that the children should be, of course, protected from being sent to labor camps at 12 years old or going to work in factories and all of that kind of thing, and I agree with all of that. There's a lot that I don't agree in that in the UN Declaration of Child Rights. This document indicates that a child has the right to be protected from corporal punishment. Spanking. Now, I would agree. We should never physically abuse a child. That's physical abuse. But spanking? The Bible affirms, in fact, the method of spanking. In fact, we know that there are some countries, I think Scandinavian countries in particular, that you can be arrested if you spank or paddle your child. And in this UN document, these rights in many cases protect a child that they do not have to be educated by their parents, of course, religious views. They have the right to say, I don't agree with you on that religion, I don't want to hear it. And the UN Declaration of Rights for the Child says, you can't teach them that. This document indicates that a minor child has the right to transgender surgery, hormone therapy, or other mutilating procedures, declaring the child's right to self-determination, even if against the parents' wishes. A minor. So I found myself saying, if I'm going to, really believe the Bible, then I cannot accept a lot of what's in that declaration. It's one thing to say, I believe the Bible completely, but then to ignore it when we try to raise our children and not raise them in the right way. Now, you will notice Paul is not speaking here in verse 4 at the first half of about, in fact, parental authority or exercising that. He's not. He's going to in the second half of verse 4 when he says, bring them up. But the first half is kind of interesting. He says, and you fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. This comes before he tells them to, in fact, bring them up. Now, why would he do that? Don't provoke your children to anger. I don't know, if you've had kids, kids get angry, right? But it's interesting here, it's kind of what I call a negative and a positive command. So the negative command is do not provoke your children to anger. Then the positive command, the second half, bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. So his admonition is first negative, then it's positive. It's kind of interesting here, the word that Paul uses is the Greek word eretizo, and it means to provoke or irritate or to incite in a negative way or to embitter. Phillips translates this as don't overcorrect. The word provoke is in the continuous tense in the Greek. Now, I'm not a Greek scholar, but reading this, it says that what that means is do not keep exasperating your children, is really what it means. So what Paul is doing here, he is assuming that, in fact, parental authority is going to be established. He's assuming that you're going to be a parent and you're going to establish your authority and your discipline. So he's urging them, when you do that, fathers and mothers too, but fathers in particular, to exercise restraint in the way in which they discipline their children. Now, I think it's important to look at the background here, because I think the background plays a part. He's writing to a church in Ephesus. Ephesus was a Gentile city in the Roman Empire. A lot of Christians were no doubt Gentiles from the Roman era, from the Roman world. And there's an interesting law in the Roman Empire. It was called in Latin the Patria Potestas. You're like, what does that mean? Well, it means the power of the father. In the Merriam-Webster dictionary, it says, the power of the head of a Roman family over his wife, children, agnatic descendants, slaves, and freedmen, including originally the right to punish by death, and always embracing complete control over the limited personal and private rights and duties of all members of the family. The Roman father had ultimate control. In fact, Barclay, in his commentary, says a Roman father had absolute power over his family. He could sell them into slavery. He could put them in chains to work in his fields. And he could punish them as he liked, even issuing a death sentence if he chose to. A Roman father had absolute power. So if you think about that, these Christians that were Gentiles came out of that Roman world, and now they're, of course, Christians, and God expects them to, of course, discipline their children. But they've got this mindset that they grew up with under Roman rule. So now Paul writes to these, you know, believers now who may have come out of that, who have been brought from darkness into light, who have understood the gospel now, who have discovered the love of God and the grace of God as expressed in the fullness of Jesus Christ. He's saying to them now, your understanding to what it means to be united with Christ, that is then going to manifest that way, that new way of life in your marriage, in the workplace, and in how you, in fact, parent your children. Now, I don't know if you've ever read books from the Victorian era. I don't know if there's any eye rolls there or not, but if you've read Dickens or the Brontes or whatever, it always portrays a father as being a tyrant, you know. No, you can't have a second bowl. You can't have a second bowl of gruel. How dare you come to me for that? I mean, it's just like a tyrant. It's almost like a Roman father. And as an engineer in the R&D medical device group at Fresenius, where I worked until I retired, when designing a medical device, one of the requirements is that the device works. It's functional. That it performs the function it is supposed to do. If you've got whole blood and it's supposed to separate it into, you know, red cells and plasma and platelets with a level of, in fact, purity, you make sure that it does what it's supposed to do. Or if you are designing a kidney dialyzer, that when blood goes through there, it pulls out those waste molecules. But that's the number two requirement. The number one requirement is that it must not harm the patient. And it's kind of like the doctor's Hippocratic Oath. Their first number one priority, do no harm. What Paul is doing here in giving instruction to the father is that in seeking to do what the father said, that the fathers do not do more harm than good. Because Paul is saying, you can take this role to such an extreme that you're harsh and you can discourage your children. You can provoke them. You can be exasperating to them. You can be irritating to them and causing them in turn to become discouraged and resentful and angry. Now let me clarify this. Those of you that are parents or have been parents or whatever, you will not go through life without angering your child. If you punish your child, I mean appropriately, because they were disobedient, they're going to get angry. They're going to get upset with you. And that's okay. All kids will get angry and will get resentful. That isn't what Paul is talking about here, though. He's talking about treating them unfairly such that it results in a sense of frustration with them, a sense of confusion. What are you doing? I don't understand this. This is way over the top. And possibly a feeling of lack of love and affection. You know, I used this on my dad once when he was going to punish me, and I deserved it. And I said, don't provoke me to anger. That didn't go well. I never did that again. And again, you see what he is saying, that the discipline by the Christian father is to be framed by the transforming power of the gospel of Christ. You're not in a Roman Empire anymore, you know, under this, you know, patria potestas. You're not like that anymore. You are a child of God, and you are to parent the same way. Paul Paul is saying, in the way that you have known the love of God towards you, that He saved you from your sins in His grace and in His goodness and the extent of His patience, that then is to be your new pattern, how you in fact parent your children. That then is to be your test in displaying your fatherly care for your children. So let's spend the balance of time that we have looking just then at this, you know, negative command, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. Now I admit, and we're going to go through this kind of fast. Now I admit, I find it uncomfortable both as a father and a grandfather to talk about this, because it uncovers in us the things that we don't want to face up to, maybe. It forces us, if you like, to examine ourselves. What specific things in my life have I done that may cause or have caused to my children to grow resentful and angry? And I hope I've never done that, but I can't say I've never done that. Why? Because I'm human. Is it possible that I have, in seeking to do the right thing, to have obscured the discipline of a truly loving father by the method of discipline more of like a human father? Again, I'm not perfect. I'm human. Now we could just fill the screen up with a lot of all kinds of examples of how we can provoke our children to anger. And we could do screen after screen after screen. And there's a lot of them that I've got a list of out there, but I'm only going to do seven, and we're going to go through these pretty quick. And I think it's probably seven of the most, you know, prevalent ones, or the ones that are, that, you know, in fact can happen. But if any of you have thought of some, I'd, you know, like to hear it to add to my growing list at home. So then, what then may provoke our children to anger? Right up front, selfishness. But what is selfishness? Preoccupation with ourselves. It's an approach to parenting that really suggests it's all about me as the parent and not about my daughter or my son. So it flies in the face of Scripture, though. Philippians 2 and verse 3, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, each esteem others better than himself. You know, if a father or mother approaches their children with that kind of attitude, that would be a good way to parent. 1 Corinthians 10:24. Let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. Isn't it true? It's like true with me. I think it's true with most people, that we see our own sins most clearly in him or her. Right? I mean, I do, and I think if we're totally honest, all of us do. You know, where I struggle with, you know, something you know, temptation, and I'm just picking something, to watch like a Matlock marathon or something. That's kind of what I'm accused of doing now that I'm retired. I watch Matlock all day and, you know, Murder, She Wrote or something. But if that's something that I have as a weakness in this kind of thing, but I don't see it in me. Look at that guy over there. He's watching, you know, like Perry Mason all the time. It's all he spends his time doing. But I don't see my, you know, weakness in myself. We see it in other people. And by the way, let me have a little side point here, if I can. As you've heard me in some of my sermons and when I've taught the adult class, I will freely admit that in times past, I've struggled with this thing, or I've struggled with that, you know, trying to study my Bible as much as I should, or I don't, you know, in fact, pray as often as I should, so I've got to work on that, and I've been right up front with that, and I don't have a problem with that, but it bothers me to some extent that some people who I've known for decades, I've never heard them admit a weakness, ever, in decades of knowing them. So either they are perfect in righteousness, or they don't want to admit that they sometimes struggle with something. And I think that's a mistake. We are all in this together, and if we put on a face of perfection, then we are not approachable to some people. So some parents also live through their kids' accomplishments. What I mean by that is, I'm really into like baseball, let's say, and my son is going to be in the Little League, and he's going to be a pitcher. And he better be the star pitcher. And Nothing wrong with that, but some parents get so over the top that they, in fact, belittle their children if they don't exceed there. When maybe the kid doesn't even like baseball. You'd rather do, what's that other sport I brought up, on another lesson, curling or something. But we do that with our kids, right? And that's selfish on our part. It's selfish. Selfishness. It's a preoccupation with my identity of who I am, and I'm trying to press that onto this little individual onto them, because I want them to be like me. Now, that's okay if I want them to be like me and I'm a faithful Christian. Great. I've told my children that their profession is important to me to the extent that, one, it doesn't interfere with serving God. Number two, it's honest work, which kind of meets the first one. And three, that it can support a family as needed. I mean, otherwise they can do whatever they want. Now, I'm pleased that they're engineers and one is a police officer, but I mean, they could have done anything, and as long as they met those three requirements, I would be happy. It is a reminder of the fact that children do not belong to us. Did you know that? They don't belong to us. We do not possess them like we possess a house or furniture or an animal. They do not belong to us. We have no right to possessively dominate them. Now, I didn't say we should not dominate them. We are the parents, and we are to dominate them, right? But not possessively dominate them. If we dominate them possessively, it can crush their personality and discourage them. We only dominate them to the extent of training them, nurturing them, and leading them to Christ. They are little people, is who they are. And they don't belong to us, they belong to God. Number one is selfishness. Number two, and we're going to go a little bit faster, is severity. And it's almost included in the first one, isn't it? Like selfishness? In other words, it's a possibility of abruptly coming down on them. It's harsh, excessive punishment, a form of tyranny. Carla tells a story. I don't know if he's holding a meeting, but he was like preaching somewhere else at another congregation. And there was a man on one of the front pews there, and he had a son. I think the son was not a young kid. It was like a teenager, and he was doing something he shouldn't have been doing, or at least the father thought he shouldn't have been doing it. The father reared back, and he hit him and knocked him off the pew and into the aisle. I forget that right or not. There's no excuse for that response. That's not biblical discipline, folks. So what does that look like, a father that does things like that? Well, everything's fine, it's going along nice and quiet and peaceful, and then out of the blue, you do something or you say something that's really petty or minor, and he totally explodes and goes over the top. Severity. Clearly, we should never take delight or satisfaction in dishing out punishment. We should dish it out as needed, but we shouldn't get a kick out of it, parents. No matter what the punishment is. And it's kind of obvious, one size doesn't fit all. So that when the exercise of discipline takes place, it has to take place in the light of the personality of the individual who's being disciplined. And you know that if you've had any children at all. They're not all the same. In fact, Steve and I was just talking here this morning about, you know, grandkids and how some of them you do one thing and it doesn't bother them at all. Some of the kids do something else, but they don't react in the same way. They don't all respond in the same way. So we have to use wisdom. For me, it would not have been effective, and they quit doing this when I was growing up. Go to your room. Go to your room. My room was full of books. I had, you know, car models that I was kind of working on at all the time. Okay, I'm going. I'd go and close my door, and I'd read a book for a while. I'd work on a model, you know. Didn't have electronics back then. That wasn't a good punishment for me because it really didn't hurt, you know. It didn't in that. But there are some children who go into apoplexy when they're threatened spanking. I know of one boy that his eyes would roll back in his head, and he began shaking if he was going to be spanked. That may not have been the best punishment for him. Maybe sending him to the room might have been better, or standing in a corner or something. I don't know. But that sure looked like it was over the top. He was absolutely terrified to the point that he was trembling. I don't know. And so I think the point is, we just need to use God's principles are there. They need to be applied wisely and individually. We don't want to be too severe. And it's not what I do, you know, it's how I do it. But what's the third one? How about inconsistency? I think this can be really a big one. In other words, one day our children would do something wrong and then they get away with it. The next day, our children are totally ignored about it. And then the third day, they are punished for it. The very same offense. Well, it's confusing to a little kid. It's confusing to a big kid. How can they ever know where they stand? Well, they can't. It's entirely inconsistent. When we are, in fact, capricious and entirely unpredictable, it's not parenting. That's not good parenting in any case. Because one day they do something wrong and we act out of temper. The next day we decide it's not worth even the effort to really deal with. And then the third day we act out of embarrassment. And a lot of times parents get really out of control because they're embarrassed, right? We act out of frustration, resulting in confused and discouraged children. Again, I'm not saying we shouldn't discipline. We absolutely should. The Bible authorizes that. But we should be consistent so they know where they stand. They can't see inside of us. They can't read our minds. And if we are continually inconsistent in the way that we approach these things, we have the risk of, in fact, breaking the command that Paul has in Ephesians 6 and verse 4. Do not provoke your children to anger. This next one here, number 4, how about unreasonableness? In other words, there's no reason for what we are doing. The kid can't figure it out. There's no obvious reason for them to see, why did you do this to me? Why did this happen? I don't understand. Why am I being punished like this? I'm really confused. You see, if we don't make it clear and obvious, the framework, the boundaries, the need for discipline, and the exercise for discipline, then our children have no way of knowing what's going on. And to me, it's a problem of not establishing clear boundaries. It's surely the toughest thing for a child, I think, when you hear the little voice say, when they get in trouble, but can I just explain it? And their answer is, no, you cannot explain. Well, then there's the next question. Well, why can't I just, let me just explain to you. No explanations necessary. What is this, the Marines? These are your children. But Dad, I didn't turn the hose off. Cindy did. Now, you may know, Cindy's my sister, my little sister. I'm a little sensitive still because I got in trouble more than once for something she did. And she didn't own up to it. And since she was Dad's pet, I got punished. So I'm a little sensitive to this, okay? Why can't I tell you I didn't turn the hose off, Dad? You're going to punish me for turning the hose off? I didn't do it. Listen, I don't want to hear about it. It's over. I've already punished you. It's unreasonable, right? I mean, there's nothing wrong with listening to them as long as they're polite. In other words, the exercise of discipline becomes mechanical and not personal. You see, God wants us to have boundaries. They're important. This is a passage that we all know, 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17. All scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine. Well, what's doctrine? It's God, telling us how we should live. For reproof, for correction, for instruction. What's instruction? God telling us how we should live. In righteousness, that the man of God may be complete, thoroughly equipped for every good work. And so let me give you number 5. So by the way, how's this going? Is this going okay? Are you enjoying this? I told you, it's kind of uncomfortable. Because we see ourselves in this. I mean, I know that I've like broken some of these, myself in the past. I'm sure I have. But number 5, failure to distinguish between childishness and willful disobedience. Failure to distinguish between childish irresponsibility and willful disobedience. Folks, and this is more to do with small kids. Small kids. Folks, children are children. They're little people. They're not like you and I. And there's all the difference in the world between childishness and willful disobedience. When a child is kind of walking through the living room and he's not paying attention like he should, he's just kind of walking through and he's kind of swinging his arms and he knocks over a glass of grape juice on Aunt Violet's 300-year-old quilt. And he's mortified because he did it and he feels really, really bad about it. You don't jump all over him. I mean, you know, you need to pay attention, but you don't take him out to the woodshed. But then you got another kid who's throwing the ball around in the living room, and he's not supposed to be doing that, and he decides, I wonder how close I can get to that glass of grape juice. He throws it, he knocks it over, and then he laughs about it. That's willful disobedience. That needs to be dealt with, right? There's a difference between the two. But if we treat the kid who accidentally did it as if he intentionally meant to do it, can we discourage them? Can we provoke them to anger? I think we can. And again, it seems so unreasonable because it is unreasonable. Another provocation, number six, would be, failure to recognize that they are making progress. I've got a policy. You know how people tend to always like to complain? You go to a restaurant or to a store, and if you get really bad service, you like to send them a bad, you know, kind of a really negative email or something. And I've done that where I've gotten really bad service too, you know. But you know what? When I've gotten service that is over the top, I mean, if they just give good service, they're supposed to. But I've had service in some cases that was totally over the top. They went above and beyond the call of duty. Well, I give a good review. Why should we only give reviews when we get mad? Same thing with raising kids. So what is this? By failing to acknowledge their attempts to please us. Well, they're supposed to. Well, yeah, but acknowledge it. Or, this is kind of a corollary to this, failure to recognizing that they are making progress, or by belittling their achievements. We got to be careful about that. Or by saying, you could have done much better than that. Now, maybe they, you know, could have. And if they weren't trying hard enough, then that is something that they should get in trouble over. But when we know that they, yeah, we wish they had done better, but they were giving 100%. They did the best they could. Don't crawl all over them. If they were doing the best, that will wound. That can wound the psyche of a child. 1 Thessalonians 5:21. Therefore, comfort each other and edify one another, just as you also are doing. Now, he's talking about the church here, right? But we are to build up. Well, we are to build up our little kids too, right? We don't only get after them when they do things wrong. When they're trying to be really good, we should acknowledge that. And I promise that will yield dividends. This guy, Haim Gano, wrote this: a child learns what he lives. If he lives with constant criticism, he does not learn responsibility. He learns to condemn himself and to find fault with others, because that's the model that he's being taught. And above all, he learns to live with continual expectation of impending doom. What a lousy way to live, right? Let's acknowledge our kids when they do good. And then the last one here is showing favoritism. Have we seen that in the Bible? Oh, yeah. Just one example here. You know, Genesis 37, verses 3 and 4. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably with him. Now, that's a problem with the brothers. That's not how they should have treated him. But you see where they're coming from. You know, dad's pet, Joseph, you know. Or by unfavorable comparisons. This is something that can happen as well. You know the standard, how it goes. Why can't you be like your brother? He always makes his bed. Again, I had a problem with that, you know, back when I was a kid. My sister always made her bed. So why can't you be like Cindy? She always makes her bed. I got other things that I want to be doing. It was wrong. I mean, I should have made my bed. I was told to, and I didn't always do it. By the way, since I've retired, I make the bed every day. Now, look at the prodigal son. This is an interesting story. I'm not going to go through all that because of time, but the brother may be a Pharisee, but he always makes his bed. So what do I mean by that? What I mean by Pharisee is he does what he's supposed to do, but not because his heart's right, not to please his parents. He just doesn't want to deal with all the aggravation of getting in trouble. But he's not doing it for the right reason. Does that describe what the Pharisees were? Yeah. They did the checklist, right? They did the checklist. But what did Jesus say? You're full of dead men's bones. Your heart's not right. Well, look at the father in the story of the prodigal son. The dad might have been able to say to the older brother, you know, look at your older brother. He never misses a day of work. He's in the fields every day working, and you're not. You're lazy. He's always perfect. Why can't you be like him? When you read the account, the actual fact in the story, the problem found in the Pharisee son, the older guy, who had always crossed the T's and dotted the I's, but his heart was not right. But the expression of love and grace is extended to the one who has made a mess of his life, but ultimately repented for it. Why? Because his heart was right. So the prodigal son's heart, once he repented, was right. The other son, who never left, never asked for the inheritance, his heart was wrong. So, am I going to, in fact, parent my child similar to how God the Father parents us? By love and grace? Or by fault-finding, unnecessary rules and regulations and endless petty corrections? Again, I'm not saying you shouldn't discipline. You shouldn't correct. I'm not saying that at all. But endless petty corrections. Now, right now, you may be saying, wow, you're on the side of the kids. You know, you're saying parents bad, kids are all bad. No. I'm only showing you what Paul is saying here in Ephesians 6 and verse 4, this negative commandment. Don't provoke your children to anger. And if you do, you run the risk of discouraging them. You know, it's possible for us as parents to create little Pharisees. They look right, they sound right, they dress right, everything. But if they have not reached those conclusions on their own, in their heart, look out. Letitia and I told our kids, we want them to be Christians more than anything. But we want them to be Christians because they want to, not because of mom and dad. Because it doesn't mean anything if they're only doing it for other reasons. It must be from their heart, otherwise God will not accept it. That's what Paul has said. We know of a person who is a Christian, and she's a Christian simply because that's what her parents were. If you ask her why she's a Christian, she goes, well, because the Bible says so. Well, why do you go to the Church of Christ? Well, because that's what mom and dad did. She can't even tell you why, and she's been a Christian for 50 years, why the Church of Christ is accurate and is true and the other ones aren't. She cannot tell you that, only because mom and dad said that. Is she a Christian because of her heart? I don't know. I can't judge her. When others have said to us, you must be really pleased how your sons have turned out. And we are. You did a great job parenting. If someone tells us that, and they have, in every case, we will say, we are quick to tell them, we tried to be godly parents, but our sons are faithful because they chose to be faithful. They made the right decisions. They get the credit for it. We tried to be good parents, but they're Christians because they chose to accept it. So that's why the wisdom that Paul displays here is so vital. Now let me, of course, conclude this. And I said, we can add a lot more to it, but we're not. None of us can actually fulfill this as God intends. Because we are too flawed, we are too fallen, we are too selfish, we are too sinful. So what are we to do? We are to remind ourselves that whatever we do is by the grace of God. We do it by the grace of God. Now you might be saying tonight, well, I thought you were going to talk about how I need to become a Christian, how I need to be saved. Well, we kind of did, right? This gives you a look at what a faithful Christian does as a parent. But surely many of us have, in fact, concluded that one reason that God has given us children is to help to sanctify us, to set us apart. Have you ever paid more than you've paid to raise your children? No. Have you ever wept as much as you've wept for your children? Have you ever cared as much as you've cared for your children? You see, this is not a 100-yard dash. This is not a weekend course. This is not a, you know, fill in the answers in the back of a slick book on parenting. This is taking God's word and putting it within our life. This is a cross-country marathon that lasts for the rest of your life. And unfortunately, we don't get to see how it ends. Because we'll die. And our kids will live after us. Will our children remain faithful unto death? Hope so. Will those that are not faithful now become faithful? Hope so. And hopefully God in His mercy and grace will complete what we started. Because children can fill you with joy one minute and make you sick with worry the next. They can make you get out of bed in the morning just excited to go do something. Or they can make you wake up at 3 in the morning wondering and worrying about your entire existence. And you're all going to relate to this next thing up here. It's work. Being a good parent, anyway, is exhausting. It's a mystery. It's filled with imponderables. Because what do we have in a child? We have a soul that was given to us by God. We are the custodians, we are the guardians in their earthly pilgrimage. And finally, and shame on us parents, as parents, if we are not the type of parents God demands. You take your songbooks. This is the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing on the moon and all that. And I was reading, there's all these shows and all these articles being written now. You almost can't step outside without, you know, stepping on something. But this one guy did an interview with Charlie Duke. And he was one of the astronauts on Apollo 16 that landed on the moon. And this guy was asking him, so what was it like walking on the moon? He goes, it was unbelievable. I can't explain it. You'd have to be there, right? And this interviewer asked him, so, you know, weren't you tempted to just not do all those experiments, but just kind of walk off and do your own thing? And didn't you want to stay longer? Because you weren't there that long. Wouldn't you want to stay longer? And Charlie Duke says, well, yeah, I wanted to, but if I had, I'd never gotten home. He says, the entire mission is planned right down to the second. In fact, he said, when we landed on the moon, we landed heavy. That means that they didn't use as much fuel as they thought they would. So do you know how much, you know, flight time that they had left in that lander after they landed? 1 minute. And that was fuel left over. I don't know. So the whole idea here is that they had to follow along with the plan. They had to follow the mission. You know, a guy that puts on an astronaut's uniform is not a rebel. He's a guy that's going to follow the rules, follow the plan. Well, similar to that, we as Christians, we got to follow the plan. There's a lot of religions out there, and Carl talked about it here this morning, that are not following the plan, right? We need to follow the plan. We need to do what's right. We need to serve God. If you're not a Christian, you need to become one tonight. before it's everlastingly too late. If you are a Christian, but you need to actually confess a public sin, you need to do that tonight before it's too late, while we stand and while we sing.